Hello, it's Tuesday the 20th of July and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. Defense Minister Seol has issued a public apology regarding the recent COVID-19 outbreak on board a destroyer off the coast of Africa. The entire unit has now returned to Korea to begin their quarantine and treatment. We'll have more in our news briefing shortly. While more regions in Korea have been stepping up their COVID-19 quarantine measures, England has lifted almost all restrictions despite growing case numbers. We'll speak to an epidemiologist in the UK to get her assessment of this situation. And then on Touch Base in Seoul, we connect with former executive producer of Friends, Kevin Bright, to talk about his latest project, a documentary on the dog meat industry here in Korea. Let's begin Korea 24. The entire 301-person contingent of the Cheonghae unit have now arrived and are safely back on Korean soil. To discuss this, as well as our other headlines of the day, we're joined in the studio by KBS World Radio news editor Eunice Kim. Hello, Eunice.
Hi, Jang-woo.
So a string of apologies came today from top government officials ahead of the soldiers' return.
Yeah, that's right. It began with the prime minister, the top official charged with the country's COVID-19 response, Kim Boo-geum, offering an apology for the government's failure to prevent the outbreak on the naval destroyer carrying the Cheonghae unit on Tuesday. Then came the apology from the defense minister, Seol, who said he takes heavy responsibility for failing to look after the safety of the unit of sailors, as he pledged the ministry will now inspect shortcomings in quarantine support for overseas service members and implement thorough measures accordingly. The apologies come, of course, after 82% of the 301 sailors of the Cheonghae unit's 34th contingent tested positive in the country's biggest cluster among service members. But they weren't enough to keep the criticisms from coming. The main opposition People Power Party is urging President Moon himself to issue a public apology and dismiss Defense Minister Seol over the anti-piracy unit's outbreak. PPP floor leader Kim Ki-hyun at a party meeting on Tuesday said the Moon administration's reasons that it's given for of logistical challenges of transporting vaccines to overseas service members is only acknowledgement of the government's ineptness in gaining help from other countries in the region.
And we know now the soldiers have safely arrived on a pair of military planes dispatched for their journey home. What happens to them now?
So according to senior health ministry officials Hoon Young-rae, upon their arrival at Seoul Air Base, the seamen will be transported to their assigned facility where they will be tested again for COVID to determine whether they need treatment or a simple quarantine. Their status will be updated at daily briefings, Hoon said, adding the service members will be guaranteed regular contact with family members. And an official from the Central Disaster Management Headquarters said at least 12 of the sailors are in serious condition and will be sent to two hospitals for treatment. The rest will be treated and held at two state-run facilities, including the 50 who tested negative.
Let's shift over to Korea's wider COVID-19 picture now. How is the nation doing today?
Sure, we are still in the four-digit range for the second week now. According to the KDCA, South Korea reported 1,278 new coronavirus cases on Tuesday, with 36 of them being overseas transmissions. 67.1% of the rest domestic cases came from the capital region, which means other parts of the country had about a third of local transmissions, or 409 in all. In fact, Lee Sang-won, who had the epidemiological research and analysis at the Central Disease Control Headquarters, said we have yet to hit the peak as there is still room for the weekly COVID-19 reproduction rate to rise further. He noted that group outbreaks only accounted for 20% of confirmed cases, indicating that new transmissions are now more spread out. The KDCA, meanwhile, projects the Delta variant could become a dominant strain in the country within weeks, as it took up 76% of all variant infections in the course of last week, July 11th through 17th, with 951 Delta cases.
Let's move on to other headlines now. We spoke about this next story on Korea Trending yesterday, the amazing feat of the fingerless mountaineer scaling the last of all 14 peaks over 8,000 meters in the Himalayas. However, there is an unfortunate turn of events as he is now missing. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, indeed. Many prayers, hope, and well wishes are going up for the safe return of Kim Hong-bin, the lifelong climber who kept climbing even after losing all of his 10 fingers from frostbite 3 decades ago. For those who may have missed his incredible achievement, Kim Hong-bin became the first climber in the world with a disability to scale all of those 14 peaks when he reached the summit of Broad Peak on the border of Pakistan and China on Sunday local time. He had said he wanted to accomplish the feat to bring hope to those weighed down by the COVID-19 pandemic. Unfortunately, according to the Union of Asian Alpine Association, Kim went missing while descending the mountain on Monday. The union said that climbers from Russia tried to rescue him, but as he was stuck in a crevice, they had failed. Pakistani military helicopters are now assisting in his rescue efforts, according to Seoul's foreign ministry, which said the South Korean embassy in Pakistan and China have requested search teams and that consular officials will be sent to the site. Taking to social media on Tuesday, President Moon expressed his concerns over the news just one day after congratulating Kim for his achievement.
Let's move on to diplomatic news. Yesterday, you brought us the news that the long-worked-for summit between President Moon and Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga would not materialize this time. And the Japanese leader has issued a response to that decision out of Seoul.
Yeah, Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga on Monday telling reporters that he was intending on receiving President Moon with diplomatic courtesy should he visit. And he added that he wants to hold significance on Seoul's top office, wishing Japan a successful Olympics. The Prime Minister then said he hopes to continue to communicate properly with the South Korean government, as has been Japan's consistent position, in order to restore a healthy relationship. And regarding a Seoul-based Japanese diplomat's indecent remarks about President Moon, Suga said they were very inappropriate and regrettable. Meanwhile, President Moon Jae-in, for his part, has also reportedly expressed regrets over the summitry outcome as he instructed his officials to continue working level consultations with Tokyo. Appearing on radio programs on Tuesday, his senior presidential secretary for public communication, Park Soo-hyun, said President Moon is sorry the trip did not materialize this time and hopes to meet the Prime Minister someday. Park reiterated that Seoul and Tokyo have made progress on pending issues, including historical matters, but that it was simply not enough to make it a summit outcome.
We have a court ruling on the financial fraud scandal involving the now-defunct Optimus Asset Management. Its head has been sentenced to 25 years behind bars for investment fraud. Can you tell us more?
Sure. The Seoul Central District Court on Tuesday additionally sentenced former Optimus CEO Kim Jae-hyun to the 25-year jail time, as well as 500 million won fine and a forfeiture of over 75 billion won. Two major shareholders also each received an 8-year jail sentence. Now, they were indicted on allegations that the company had caused hefty losses after investing in risky assets instead of relatively safer public institutions, as it promoted when soliciting 1.3 trillion won from investors. Confirmed victims of the hedge fund scandal reach 3,200, but the actual number is believed to be higher. Some half a trillion won still needs to be reimbursed to the victims.
And finally, the public will be able to get a first look at the donated artworks once owned by the late Samsung Group chairman at two major art museums in Seoul starting tomorrow.
Yes, that's right. The National Museum of Korea and the Museum of Modern and Contemporary Art will each host dedicated exhibits featuring a total of 135 key pieces and cultural assets from the so-called Igonhee Collection on Wednesday. The National Museum of Korea has selected 77 from over 21,000 pieces of art and cultural assets that were donated by Lee's family. Among them will be 12 national treasures, including National Treasure No. 216, which is the Joseon-era landscape painting by legendary painter Chung Sun. And meanwhile, over at the Museum of Modern and Contemporary Art, it will put on display 58 works by 34 domestic artists from the early to mid-20th century. And among the featured works will be be abstract master Kim Hwan-gi's painting of women and jars from the 1950s, as well as painter Lee Jung-seop's painting of a white bull, also from the 1950s, with only five pieces believed to remain.
Eunice, thank you for those updates today.
You bet.
Coming up next, in-depth news analysis. You're listening to Korea 24 from KBS World Radio.
As more regions in South Korea step up their social distancing measures amid the fourth wave of the pandemic, on Monday, England eased almost all of its domestic COVID-19 restrictions in what many people have dubbed Freedom Day. There are now no more limits on the size of social gatherings, face coverings will not be required by law, pubs and restaurants will no longer be restricted to table service only. The move, however, comes as the nation is experiencing a surge in new cases caused by the highly transmissible Delta variant. And criticism is mounting on Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his government, with some scientists calling the latest move a dangerous and unethical experiment. To help us better understand the situation in the UK and what lessons it could provide to other countries, we have joining us on the line now Dr. Deepti Gurdasani, a clinical epidemiologist and senior lecturer at Queen Mary University of London. Hello, Dr. Gurdasani. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Could you bring us up to speed on the current coronavirus situation in the UK? How many daily cases is the UK seeing and how is the vaccination drive going?
So we're in the middle of a crisis in the UK. We have more than 50,000 daily cases that are doubling about 11 to 14 days. We are seeing a rise in hospitalizations as well, although not at the level we would have been without the current level of vaccination. So we're seeing about 700 or so people being admitted to hospital every day. And about 54% of our population is fully vaccinated at this point in time. So while the proportion of adults being vaccinated is much higher as a proportion of the whole population, it's still only half, and the remaining are either vaccinated with only one dose or completely unvaccinated.
So you say the situation is escalating, but then on Monday, the UK government lifted almost all pandemic restrictions in England, including an indoor mask mandate. Why did the UK government make such a decision at this time?
I mean, you'd have to ask them, but it's certainly not in line with the scientific consensus. I mean, most scientists and healthcare workers are extremely concerned about events in the UK. We've essentially been told that a result of the UK strategy will be millions getting infected over the coming weeks, and these will be predominantly the young, which means that we will end up with potentially hundreds of thousands of people living with long COVID, which is one of the syndromes that follows acute infection, and thousands with potentially chronic disability, particularly among our young and children. Our hospitals are already filling up, and they're finding it very difficult already to cope with the number of people coming to emergency departments and having to cancel once again routine care for those with cancer and routine operations. We already have a backlog of about 5 million people waiting for care partly because of the two devastating waves that we've already been through. And it looks like those backlogs will continue to increase further as care gets diverted towards COVID.
So it's clear that you have deep concerns about the situation. What about the vaccination rate? I understand almost 90% of the adult population in the UK have at least one shot of the vaccine and 70% two shots. This was the point where we were told that herd immunity should have taken effect already, but that doesn't seem to be happening.
No, actually, it wouldn't have, because, I mean, when they talk about those proportions, they are the proportion of adults, and children exist, and they get infected and they transmit, and potentially even more than adults, given the high levels of exposure they have in schools. So as a proportion of the entire population, we only have 54% of people who've been given two doses, and we have this new Delta variant that has a significant level of escape against vaccines, which means those with one dose can definitely get infected and transmit. And even those with two doses, although the risk is reduced, can also get infected and transmit. And herd immunity doesn't depend on the effectiveness against severe disease. It depends on the effectiveness against getting infected and transmitted. And with a variant as transmissible as the Delta variant to reach herd immunity threshold, you need 85% of the population immune, not vaccinated, immune. And we are very, very far from that because we don't even know what vaccine efficacy is against transmission with the Delta variant yet. And it's quite possible that even if 100% of our population were fully vaccinated, which is, of course, very unlikely given young children are not even eligible yet, we still very likely wouldn't reach herd immunity thresholds. I mean, you can look at countries like Israel, which have higher rates of vaccination than us and are struggling with a Delta variant outbreak and have reintroduced mask mandates indoors and are pushing to vaccinate adolescents because they're a key group that transmits this virus and needs to be vaccinated to get anywhere near the herd immunity threshold.
You mentioned Israel. Singapore is another country that had thought about loosening its COVID-19 rules but then decided to tighten restrictions due to a rising number of cases. Is Singapore and Israel comparable to the situation in the UK or even here in South Korea? Because they do have very differing population sizes. Singapore is an island state of 5.7 million, whereas the UK is estimated a population of 66 million. Is it fair to compare the two situations, considering the drastic difference in land size and population?
I think we can compare them. And, you know, even if you don't want to compare those, there are, I think, so many examples like South Korea, like Taiwan, that are comparable. And, you know, when we compare these countries, we're talking about the resources they have and what they've put in place. So in terms of, you know, putting in good surveillance, test, trace and isolate systems, quarantine systems, vaccination rollout, I think that's about resourcing. And the UK is a country that's extremely well resourced. It's an island nation. So I think that we can make those comparisons because the UK has the capabilities of putting in the same public health systems. Like putting in indoor mask mandates is not a matter of population size. Protecting children in schools and vaccinating adolescents is not a matter of population size. It's a matter of public health policy, which every well-resourced country can do.
You mentioned earlier that even if there's a 100% vaccination rate, that might not mean that we reach herd immunity. That will, I'm sure, scare a lot of people. When would the right time be to declare an end to this pandemic, to have a point where we can ease COVID-19 restrictions? It has to come at some point, doesn't it?
Yes, and I think we need to be honest. So we need to be honest that we may not attain herd immunity with the current vaccines, which may not be effective enough to attain this even with 100% of the population vaccinated. And that means that relying on vaccines alone at this point in time is not sufficient. So I think the strategy that's being used in Israel is the right one, where they're combining mitigations with vaccinations, fully realizing that vaccination alone might not be enough. And I think that's a major point, again, sort of living with the virus. The reason we're in this situation where we may not be able to attain herd immunity is because we allowed a new variant globally to evolve and enter many countries, and that's the Delta variant. And as long as we continue with narratives of living with the virus and letting transmission continue, this virus will likely continue to adapt and more escape variants will emerge, which will make this even harder. I mean, what's happening in South Korea is essentially a result of a highly transmissible variant that's entered the country. And much of Southeast Asia that was very good at surveillance and stopping community transmission is struggling with this because, you know, as more transmissible variants emerge, it's harder and harder to achieve zero COVID and elimination. And the only way that I think we're going to get out of this pandemic is a global pivoting towards elimination and supporting countries that are poorly resourced with elimination through vaccinations and mitigation. Unless we globally realize this is not a virus that's like the flu and one that we want to live with, we are going to be stuck in this for a long period of time. But it takes political will to change that. And I think what the future holds is entirely dependent on the governments actually looking at the reality of this and deciding that this is a virus that we need to eliminate, not live with.
Those are some pretty stark warnings there. South Korea currently, as you mentioned, it's struggling with a fourth wave of the outbreak, seeing a steep rise in infections. But the situation admittedly here is far less severe than the UK. But what has concerned us is the fact that UK, far ahead in its vaccination drive, is still seeing cases rises. And that falls in line with what you're saying. So then what can countries like South Korea right now do as we see these numbers rise? What lessons can South Korea learn from the situation in the UK?
I think South Korea needs to learn that you know, this is not a virus we can live with. And I think they're taking the right steps to contain that. They need to aggressively contain this variant, because once it enters the community and spreads, it's like a wildfire. It's very, very hard to control because it's so much more transmissible through aerosols. And what we need is strong measures to contain aerosol transmission, and even in outdoor crowded places where we are seeing spread happening in a way we didn't with previous variants. And, you know, vaccination is an important part of this because it does prevent severe consequences. But at the same time, I think they need to aim for elimination, because I think experience from Israel and UK and so many other countries now in Southeast Asia tells us that health of people will be severely threatened if a virus like this is allowed to spread, because it spreads so quickly. And this really makes me worried about what future virus evolution holds for elimination zones, or former elimination zones in Southeast Asia, because this virus becomes harder and harder to eliminate with every new variant that arises. And that's why I think we need a global strategy to tackle this, because I'm really concerned about events in the UK leading to potentially a new variant adapting, because we are allowing high levels of transmission in a partially vaccinated population that really pushes this virus towards adaptation. And this will threaten what happens not just in the UK, but globally, because it gets harder and harder to tackle this as new, more transmissible and more severe variants arise.
And very briefly, Doctor, when you say elimination, what do you mean by that? How do we eliminate these variants or the virus?
So it means tackling them aggressively in the community, and that means, sadly, localized lockdowns where clusters are emerging, because that's the only way to tackle such transmissible variants. It means very strong mitigation in schools, because we found in the UK and many other countries, I think Singapore saw this too, that those are a major area of spread. And, you know, it might require very strong control measures in schools for brief periods of time until they get rid of it. It means very strong quarantine measures. So, for example, South Korea has exemptions for people who are doubly vaccinated. But with the Delta variant, we know that's not sufficient protection against getting the variant and transmitting to others. And that might be a key area, how new variants sort of enter the country. And unfortunately, in the current world we live in, where new variants are arising that are huge threats to elimination zones, they need to be stopped at the border, which means very strong mandatory quarantine at borders with other areas that are not elimination zones, but making green corridors with areas that are.
Right. South Korea has, of course, paused those exemptions for now who have had a double vaccination shots, as the number of cases has been surging with this fourth wave of the pandemic here. But that was expected to come back at some point. But from what you've said today, you have painted a grim picture indeed. And perhaps we should all be rethinking our expectations. You've given us a lot to think about. We'll have to leave it there. We've been speaking to Dr. Deepti Gudasani from Queen Mary University. Thank you for your time today.
No, thanks for having me.
We've come now to our special daily segment, Going for Gold, building up to the Tokyo 2020 Summer Olympics and looking over South Korea's medal prospects before we bring you the latest results and updates once the games start. Joining me in the studio now for that is our staff editor, Mark Wilson-Chair. Mark, hello. Hope you're doing well.
I'm doing great. Thanks for asking.
Okay, so Mark, we have come now to one of my favourite sports, although perhaps not as high profile during the Olympics, and that is football, or as Americans might call it,
soccer.
Football, as that's what it's called in the Olympics as well. We are specifically talking about men's football today, as the Team Korean women's team didn't qualify this time. We've actually been talking quite a lot about the men's team on the show in recent weeks, as there have been warm-up matches and selection headaches, but the actual games are almost upon us now. So, Mark, can you get us started? Fill us in on this year's event.
It'd be my pleasure. Let's first talk about some of the major changes to this year's event compared to past Summer Olympics. First is the fact that the majority of the athletes will be a tad older than usual, as the games typically set the age restriction for players to be under 23. But because of the 2020 Olympics being postponed a year due to the COVID-19 pandemic, football's world governing body, FIFA, bumped the age restriction up to under 24. With that said, the games will still continue to allow three exceptions to this, also known as wildcard players, to be over said age limit.
Let me just stop you there. The age limit bump up is especially important for players in Team Korea as well, of course, because I don't think we've covered this yet, but any male athlete who wins a medal at the Olympics gets an exemption from the mandatory military service here. So they're essentially being rewarded for serving their country in a different capacity.
Yeah.
So if they had kept the age limit at 23, some players that might have been eligible last year might have missed out on a chance to win a medal. But thankfully for them, that hasn't happened. The age limit has been bumped up a year, so they do have this chance to get a medal and perhaps get a military exemption. Okay, so Mark, what other changes are there to the format this year?
Okay, let's talk about the expanded roster. 18 was the magic number. 18, who's it going to be? 18, 18. Every week after week, we've been talking about that number. But up until FIFA decided to allow four alternates to become part of the main roster, bringing the total to 22. This allows coaches to switch players more easily without having to dip into a pool of alternates. Also, for the very first time, the video assistant referee, or VAR, or VAR system, will be used. The VAR can review decisions made by the head referee with the use of video footage and a direct line of communication.
Okay, so let's delve into Team Korea's chances of grabbing a medal this time. They've only ever won bronze before, and that was in London 2012.
Yeah.
But this time, some are even tipping them for gold, Mark.
That is correct, as it seems some things are lining up just right for Team Korea to achieve success. If this were a board game, let's just say that South Korea just got a pretty good roll of the die just before its turn. Of course, it's not just about luck. The first major factor is that Team Korea is bringing a strong squad. Led by coach Kim Hak-bum, the national squad won the title at the 2020 Asian Football Confederation, or the AFC, Under-23 Championship last January. The top three teams qualify as the AFC representatives, which are South Korea, Australia, and Saudi Arabia. Which leads me into the next factor, representation depending on continental confederations. I just said the three of the AFC, but what really helps Team Korea, as well as a lot of the other teams competing, is that Europe can only send out four representatives. This is a good thing, because Europe is a FIFA powerhouse, so the less competition to come out of that region, the better. The four coming from that region, still pretty terrifying in their own right. Spain, France, Germany, and Romania.
Right, so Romania are arguably the weakest of the four there, and another factor that plays into Korea's hands is that Romania is the only team from Europe that is in our group.
Oh, yeah, that's very true. And that's another factor I want to touch on is Team Korea's initial group placement. Statistically and historically speaking, South Korea stands a very good chance of coming out on top of Group B against New Zealand, Romania, as you said, and Honduras. It'll be the first Olympic match against Romania, but Team Korea has winning records against the two other teams when it comes to past Olympics. But that's where it ends, as Team Korea will face off against the much stronger opponents in the knockout stage, such as the likes of defending Olympic champ Brazil, gold medal candidate Spain, and of course rival Japan.
Right, so essentially Team Korea should comfortably get out of Group B, but it's the next match that people need to keep an eye out for, because that's going to be up against a Group A, which consists of Japan, France, Mexico, and South Africa.
Yep.
That will be a tough task, especially those first two I mentioned. But if they win that, Team Korea could be into the semifinals, meaning that they're in with a shout of a medal as well.
That's right.
Right, so we know what we're up against, but let's end with who we're bringing to the table. Who are some of the names to look out for in the upcoming games?
Well, let's start with the three veterans, the wild cards. There's 28-year-old forward Hwang Lee-jo of League One's Bordeaux, 27-year-old attacking midfielder for the Suwon Samsung Blue Wings, Kwon Chang-hoon, and 27-year-old center-back for Gimcheon Sangmu, Park Ji-soo. One wildcard candidate that was not added, however, and we talked about, arguably one of the biggest names in the sport, period, Tottenham Hotspur Son Heung-min. He jumped through a lot of hoops with the Premier League club to be eligible, but Coach Kim ultimately decided not to add him for his own protection.
Yes, that will have been disappointing for Korean fans. Another huge disappointment was the fact that defender Kim Min-jae, a.k.a. the Monster, was another wildcard initially picked, but his team, Beijing, did not let him go in the end due to transfer negotiation reasons, which we won't get into, but that has been a huge loss to the defense as well. Can the team do it without Son and Kim? Well, we'll just have to see. Meanwhile, who else has been picked, Mark?
Well, there's Song Bum-gun of the Jeonbuk Hyundai Motors, and winner of the Best Goalkeeper Award at the AFC Under-23 Championship. He's going to be guarding the net. He'll be joined by two defenders from Daegu FC, Jung Tae-wook and Kim Jae-woo. In the midfield, there's Lee Kang-in, and as a player for La Liga's Valencia, he's reportedly warned Coach Kim about Team Spain. And at the front, there's Song Min-gyu, who apparently, I just learned, just switched over to Jeonbuk from the Pohang Steelers. That just happened earlier today. And also on Hyundai's Lee Dong-jun, the two of them made their debut on the national squad's A-team.
Right, Lee Kang-in is the name to look out from there. He should bring creativity and control to the side. We should finally point out that the football games start before the opening ceremony of the games due to the schedule they need to play all the games and the rest in between. The women's games start tomorrow, Wednesday, while the men's start Thursday. Team Korea will first face New Zealand on Thursday, 5 p.m. local time, which is the same here. That's the first match that we would be looking out for.
Yeah.
And that's where we leave it for Going for Gold today. Thank you, Mark, for that preview, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Talk to you then.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index fell 11.34 points, or 0.35% on Tuesday, closing the day at 3,232.70. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also fell, losing 6.19 points, or 0.59%, to close at 1,043.64. On the foreign exchange, the local currency weakened 2.61 against the dollar, ending the day at 1,150.41.
You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next up, it's our roundup of some of the other news stories that have been attracting attention online in Korea today. It is our daily segment, Korea Trending. And with those stories for us is Lee Joo-young, who joins us on the line now. Joo-young, hello.
Hello, Jang-ho.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Our first story is about a newly revealed government guideline to fight the spread of COVID-19 within South Korea's entertainment scene. We then talk about a case regarding a teenage boy who was allegedly killed by his mother's ex-boyfriend. Our last story is about K-pop phenomenon BTS snatching another number one spot on the Billboard's Hot 100 with their third all-English single, Permission to Dance.
Okay, let's get started on our first story then. And it's about COVID-19 guidelines in the entertainment sector. Can you tell us more?
Sure. Following a recent spike in the number of celebrities who have tested positive for COVID-19, the Korea Communications Commission and the Ministry of Culture, Sports, and Tourism held a meeting today and revealed strengthened guidelines on quarantine management in the broadcasting industry. It also revealed a list of recommendations for TV personalities to follow to be more proactive in the fight against the coronavirus spread. While the television industry has stayed relatively safe from the infectious virus, some have raised concerns over working environments, with most TV personalities working in small spaces and not wearing masks during shoots.
Okay, before we get into these specific guidelines, can you tell us who was infected recently?
Sure. A number of people who appeared on the program We Kick Together, including volleyball player-turned-TV personality Kim Yo-han, Olympic gold medalist swimmer Park Tae-hwan, and speed skater Mo Tae-bom tested positive, which led to the production of the show to be called off. Singers Jang Min-ho and Young Tak, who rose to fame from the popular trot audition program Mr. Trot, tested positive as well. The recent series of infections has raised concerns that the outbreak may spread even more within the industry.
Yes, that is indeed concerning. So let's delve into the new guidelines then. What changes are there?
Firstly, the KCC and the Culture Ministry will form a joint inspection team to intensively inspect the filming sites to make sure all quarantine measures are being kept. The quarantine manager will be designated at each site to conduct related tasks like checking for fever and overseeing who goes in and out of the premises. And when filming inside a studio, ventilation and disinfection tasks need to be thoroughly handled as well. The government also recommends that the entertainers use a self-COVID-19 test kit to check for infection before each shoot. For those who take part in programs with many other participants, they're advised to undergo regular PCR tests for more thorough checkups. The government said it will penalize broadcasters that fail to comply with quarantine rules, like, for example, limiting their participation in government-backed projects.
Okay, so a strengthening of protocols on set, which will hopefully help avoid the spread of the virus at these potentially vulnerable sites, as well as alleviate any concerns that viewers might have as well while watching these shows. Let's move on to our second story now. What do you have for us?
Police arrested a man in his 40s who is charged for killing the teenage son of his ex-girlfriend. The Jeju Dongbu police station said today that it arrested the 48-year-old man for murder and is investigating him. The man is charged for killing the 16-year-old at the teen's home located in the northeastern part of Jeju Island on Sunday afternoon. The teenager was reportedly alone at the time of the murder, and his body was found by his mother at around 11 p.m. on the same day. The man also had an accomplice, also a male in his 40s, and the two reportedly fled the scene. Both were caught, albeit in different locations.
So a very grim set of circumstances indeed. Do we have any details on the man's motivation for this crime?
At the moment, no, as the police are trying to figure out the details as well. Police suspect, however, that the man committed the crime out of spite when his relationship with his ex-girlfriend went awry. When reporters asked him questions as he was being taken to the police station, he admitted to the charges held against him and briefly apologized when asked what he wanted to say to the bereaved family members. When asked about his motivations, he refused to answer and said that he will answer later.
Right, so he has admitted to the charges, but I understand that there were signs leading up to the incident that suggested that this man was capable of such actions.
Right, well, the woman was, in fact, threatened by the man before and asked the police for protection earlier this month. The police reportedly installed CCTV cameras around the house's premises and strengthened patrols. Sadly, it wasn't enough to stop the terrible incident from happening.
Right, so questions will be asked whether more could have been done by the police to prevent this terrible crime. Okay, let's move on to our final story now. What else do you have for us?
K-pop phenomenon BTS has done it again with their third all-English hit, Permission to Dance, debuting at number one on the Billboard's Hot 100 main singles chart. Their latest milestone was announced by Billboard on Monday local time. What makes it all the more special is that Permission to Dance, which is a follow-up to their song Butter, replaced Butter on the top spot, which had been maintaining its position for seven consecutive weeks. The septet expressed their joy and surprise on social media and thanked their fans for all the support.
Wow, so after 7 weeks at number one, they have a new song at number one. Incredible indeed.
Exactly.
So can you break it down for us a bit more? How many people listened to Permission to Dance?
So during the week ending July 15th, the song sold over 140,000 downloads while recording nearly 16 million U.S. streams and about 1.1 million radio listeners. Butter dropped down to seventh place on the Hot 100, but that still means BTS has two songs in the top 10. Olivia Rodrigo's song Good For You remained in second place, followed by artists like The Kid LAROI and Dua Lipa.
Right, so with this new feat, how many times has BTS secured the top spot on the Hot 100?
Well, that would be 13 times in total. Like I mentioned, Butter stayed on the throne for 7 weeks, three times with Dynamite, and one each with Permission to Dance, Savage Love, Lack Siren Beat, and Life Goes On, which is the group's first predominantly Korean song to top the chart. Billboard said that since Dynamite's release in late August last year, BTS created a total of five number one songs in a period of 10 months and 2 weeks, which is the shortest time since King of Pop Michael Jackson secured five number one hits with songs in his 1987 album Bad.
Right, and in the meantime, I understand they are the first group to have four songs debut at number one. The only others to have achieved that feat are individual artists, Ariana Grande, Justin Bieber, and Drake. So another remarkable achievement in their incredible journey. Well done to them again. That's all we have time for on today's Korea Trending. Thank you for bringing us those stories, Juyoung, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Sure thing.
Our guest for this week's Touch Base in Seoul is American television producer and director Kevin Bright, who is best known for being one of the executive producers of the smash hit US sitcom Friends. And as much as I'd like to talk about his time on that show. He has joined us today to talk about his latest directorial work, and that's a documentary on the dog meat industry here in South Korea. It's called Nurangi, and it's an unflinching work that delves into the history and culture of dog meat consumption in Korea, as well as the conflicting attitudes towards it in Korean society. The documentary premiered at the Seoul Eco Film Festival in June, and I'm glad to say that we're able to connect with him in LA via video call. Mr. Bright, thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
Can you first tell us about how you began making this documentary? When did you first learn about dog meat culture and its industry here in South Korea?
I learned about dog meat culture about 5 years ago. And, you know, when I first found out about it, I thought, you know, must be some mistake because, you know, I know Korea is one of the top economies in the world, one of the top educational systems. And somehow dog meat didn't seem in character. So I made a trip with my wife, who is co-founder of an organization that rescues dogs from the dog meat industry in Korea and brings them to the United States. And so I went with her. And when I got there, I found a lot of confusion, a lot of misunderstanding amongst the Korean people about the dog meat industry. And I thought I found a great story.
So you found this story. When did the idea of making a documentary come into the equation? Why did you want to make it into a documentary?
Well, as I said, I'm, you know, primarily, you know, although I've been focused in comedy for many years, I consider myself to be a storyteller. And when I saw all of this confusion in Korea around the dog meat industry, I recognized a good story. And I just wanted to tell it.
But when you say confusion, was it from just the people you met in your time in Korea?
Yes, people that I met. Certainly, as I started to do the film, the confusion grew, if anything, as I started to talk to people on the street. But my executive producer, Tammy Chosassman, who is a Korean-American, a lot of the information came from some of her relatives and friends who were still inside of Korea. And also, Tammy is very well-versed with Korean culture.
Okay, so when you say confusion, what do you mean by that?
So there was confusion, first of all, that whether or not dog meat was legal or illegal. There was confusion over how many dogs were slaughtered annually inside the country, how many dog farms there are in Korea. And I think out of all of this comes the realization of how many total dogs there are in Korea at any given time. So, yeah, I think there was certainly a lot of confusion.
You managed to get a wide range of voices in the film and doing a deep dive into this issue, including those involved in the dog meat industry, from the industry leaders to owners of dog farms, to restaurant owners who serve dog meat and those who eat there as well. And you seem to have been given a lot of access. What was that process like with the industry already not having so much of a positive image? I would have thought that it might have been difficult to get consent and access from these people like you did.
Well, I promised everybody who was in the film one thing, is that I was going to make an unbiased film and represent all sides equally in the film. And the Dog Meat Association, I obviously filmed with their full cooperation. And also, you know, I would say they were very confident about their own position, about the place of dog meat in Korean tradition, and the feeling that the dogs were slaughtered very humanely. So that I got access to show these things, now it's up to the Korean people to decide whether it's humane or not.
Yes, and as I said in the introduction, it's a very unflinching work, at times very difficult to watch. And I would warn anyone interested in the movie that there were some graphic and difficult scenes to witness. You certainly didn't seem to turn away from anything and showed everything in the cold light of day, Mr. Wright.
I felt that I had to in order for everyone to truly understand all aspects of this industry and to come to their own conclusion about the place that it should have in contemporary Korean culture.
As you said, you met with regular Korean people you interviewed. We also heard from animal activists, veterinarians, and dog trainers. What did you learn that perhaps you didn't know when you started?
Well, I think it's more about what I learned that I already knew, is that a dog is a dog and that all dogs are the same. And what I learned about the industry in Korea was that it was very complex, that it was not just some industry where there were a bunch of people getting rich off of, you know, suffering dogs, that actually a good part of the dog meat industry was immersed in poverty. And so that was something that I learned that made me realize it's very complex.
The film is available to watch here on YouTube, understand for free. And interestingly, though English subtitles are available, it is presented in Korean with the title and description in Korean first and Korean subtitles embedded into the actual film. It seems like the documentary is aimed at a Korean audience. Would that be correct? And is that what you had in mind?
Yes, I made this film specifically for the Korean audience because, as I said in the beginning, I felt there was a story to tell. The end of the story is up to the Korean people. I've given all the information that I could find and tried to get presented in an unbiased way. And now it's really up to the Korean people to decide whether dog meat still has a place in contemporary society.
So there's nothing specifically that you perhaps want Korean audiences to take away. You want the Korean audiences to come to their own conclusions.
Well, as I said before, one thing I'd like them to come away with is that there's no difference in dogs. There's no such thing as pet dog and meat dog. All dogs are the same. And I think Hunter says it really well in the film. They see the same, they smell the same, you know, there's really no difference between these dogs.
And Hunter, of course, audiences in Korea will perhaps better know him as Kang Hyung-wook, who is a very famous dog trainer here, appearing on television shows and other shows or TV shows as well. Now, Nurangi first appeared, premiered in June at the Seoul Eco Film Festival, and since it's been released on YouTube last month, it's garnered over 300,000 views. What has been the response been like so far?
Well, the majority of the responses you can see from the comments has been very positive, very grateful that I made a film that was not a Korean bashing film, that it was respectful, that it was unbiased, and that they learned a lot about their own country, really, from this film.
Have those in the dog meat industry that you interviewed, have they seen the movie?
Yes, they have. They actually saw the film more than a month before it was released, several months. And as you can imagine, the unbiased nature of it did not really appeal to them. They really wanted a film that was promoting dog meat rather than giving an unbiased view.
Right, so they had a perhaps negative reaction to it. What was your reaction to their reaction?
Well, you know, as I started out this film with having respect for the Dog Meat Association, I hope that in the end of our exchange, you know, that respect was still felt. There was obviously a, well, not obviously, but there was an adverse reaction on the part of the dog meat industry to the film. They thought it was a lie. They thought the film has to be destroyed. No one should ever see it. And, you know, I told them that part of it was not a possibility. We can talk about the content of the film. But honestly, at that meeting, there were many things that were a couple of things that were said. I can't remember specifically what they were, but that gave me second thoughts about the film. And I actually went back and made some changes according to some of the feedback that I got from them. So ultimately, since it was not a pro dog meat film, they're never going to be happy with it. And I don't know. In hindsight, they may have a different feeling about allowing me to film the slaughter, because I think that's the key to understanding. You know, I think we may or may not know something about how the food we eat arrives on our table, whether it's chicken or cows or pigs. We may not know much how they're slaughtered, but I felt it was my job to look into that. Because that is a huge difference in play here. No other animal is slaughtered by electrocution like that. And it is inhumane. The Korean Assembly has deemed it to be inhumane. It is an inhumane form of capital punishment that has been banned in the United States. So part of the, you know, knowing that something is wrong with this industry is when you see that slaughter and when you understand that there's no regulation really of the dog meat industry in the same way that cows and pigs and chickens are regulated and inspected on a regular basis and tested. The dog meat industry is just the Wild West there, and there's no control over it whatsoever.
And finally, do you think as an outsider, you were able to view it in the cold light of day in an unbiased way?
You know, I would say that I was able to overcome any bias that I had during the process of this, because I understood that the issue was complex. I didn't set out to make a film that reflected what I felt about dog meat. I set out to make a film that presented all the information and took away the confusion around dog meat so that the people who have something to say about dog meat and whether or not it should be in the future is the people of Korea. And that's who I made the film for.
And I do think it is a powerful work and also an important document to the situation concerning the dog meat industry here in South Korea. Once again, the film is called Nurangi and it's out now to watch on YouTube. And we've been talking to its director, Kevin Bright, for this week's Touch Base in Seoul. Mr. Bright, we appreciate you making the time to appear on our show today.
Okay, next time we'll talk about Friends, okay?
Yes, I'd love that.
Okay, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
And we close out our show there today. We'll be back same time tomorrow, so we hope you can join us again then. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-won, and thank you, as always, for listening. Goodbye.
KBS World Radio. KBS World Radio strives to promptly update our listeners on safety procedures during emergency situations. The following are recommended guidelines to follow in case of extreme heat. Prepare fans or air conditioners at your home. The recommended air conditioning temperature during the summer is 26 to 28 degrees Celsius. If you do not have access to air conditioning, make sure that your house is well ventilated. Take a brimmed hat or sunglasses when you go outside, and don't forget to wear sunscreen. Refrain from drinking caffeinated drinks or alcohol. Instead, drink water or sports drinks. Also, do not leave your children or pets in your car with the windows closed, as the temperature can get extremely high inside. If you show symptoms of headaches, nausea, or muscle spasms, immediately move to a cooler place to rest and sip a cold drink. Local governments provide rest areas for people who are outdoors and for those who do not have access to air conditioning. You can find rest areas from the local government's websites. If you need emergency assistance, you can dial 119 for emergency services. Please check our website at world.kbs.co.kr for up-to-date information and procedures.